The Guardian.
The Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences has decided to award the 2010 Nobel Prize in Physics jointly to...
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On this week's podcast, Britain leads this year's Nobel Prizes.
This year's Nobel Prize in Physics is about a two-dimensional material with amazing properties.
We hear from one of the winners.
You split it to the limit of a single atomic plane. That was originally done with the help of just scotch tape.
And with the problems over UK science funding looming, we hear about a similar situation decades ago, which could have hampered one of this year's other British Nobel Prize winners.
The MRC declined to fund that, and they had concerns about the ethics.
Also in this show, we go underground with science personified Professor Brian Cox.
This is the CMS detector, part of the largest and most complicated scientific experiment ever attempted.
And as the old saying goes, try everything once except incest and folk dancing. But it turns out most people have been ignoring that advice. And I don't mean the activity that usually involves strange costumes and bells.
I've never undergone folk dancing, but I certainly have undergone quite a lot of incest, at least in the broader sense.
Well, actually, they probably both could involve strange costumes and bells, but you know what I mean.
As you go north through Britain, sex stops at Preston. There are some sexless patches further south. There's very little sex in Cambridge.
This is a Too Closely Related for Comfort edition of Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome back, everyone. We're going to begin this week with the biggest prizes in science. Every year, the Swedish and Norwegian Academies of Science get together to award the Nobel Prizes, each one a 10 million krona check to the team or individual in recognition of a lifetime of achievement in medicine, physics, or chemistry. With me in the studio to discuss the 2010 prizes, the man who should be awarded a Nobel Prize for his services to science journalism, if that existed, brackets, Scottish edition, Robin McKee. Hi, Robin.
Hi there.
You won any prizes?
Lots.
You won two this year, in fact.
Yeah.
You won the Nobels of Science Journalism, in fact, this year, haven't you?
Yeah.
Feature writing and something else.
Yes.
What was the other one?
I was shortlisted for News Story.
That's right, yes. Good man. And this year's audience prize for being the most popular woman in this science pod, Guardian's Nell Bowes. Sorry, we don't aim high with these prizes. Let's look at the Nobel Prizes more closely, though. First, physics.
The Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences has decided to award the 2010 Nobel Prize in Physics jointly to Professor Andrei Geim and Professor Konstantin Novoselov, both at the University of Manchester, United Kingdom. And the Academy citation runs for groundbreaking experiments regarding the two-dimensional material graphene.
Who better to talk about this in more detail than one of the winners themselves? Live from Manchester University, it's Andrei Geim. First of all, congratulations. Why don't you start by telling us what graphene actually is?
You know that all material consists of atoms, and atoms are arranged in rows and rows arranged in planes. So graphene is one atomic plane of graphite, but it's pulled out of graphite. It has to be isolated to show its properties.
And what are some of those properties? I mean, they're quite remarkable.
It's a whole range of various properties. Graphene, every material can be characterized by some adjectives. And in the case of graphene, there are plenty of not only adjectives but superlatives. Graphene is the thinnest possible material. It has the highest surface-to-volume ratio. 1 gram of material would be enough to cover several football pitches. It's also the strongest material we have ever measured. It's at the same time, it's the stiffest material we know. It's stiffer and stronger than diamond. This material at the same time try to stretch diamond, it would break. Graphene is a little bit like rubber. It can be stretched and returned to its initial position. It also conducts heat better than diamonds. Or any other material, it conducts electricity better than copper, in fact, million times better than copper. It shows semiconducting properties, which in many cases better than any other semiconductor, including silicon, and okay, the list goes on and on.
When we talk about big prizes in science, when you describe how these things were normally discovered, they usually involve huge amounts of equipment and technological expertise. Now, you found graphene in a very sort of, let's say, low-tech way.
Well, in a sense, it's correct. This experiment everyone can do at home, take a piece of graphite or a piece of mica and start splitting this material into two pieces, then again into two pieces, and then try to reach the ultimate limits that on your table there is only one piece left. You split it into to the limit of a single atomic plane. That was originally done with the help of just scotch tape. That's how it was done originally. Everyone can do this.
It sounds like a remarkable material, as you've described. What kinds of things do you envisage it might be used for?
Say graphene as a surface for your mobile phones, screens, touch screens, monitors and computer screens, and they expect the first applications to come in 2-3 years time. Most importantly probably would be consequences for optical communications and communications in general with extremely fast transistors for communications, and which would allow us to expand the range of frequencies available, say, for mobile phones or for internet communication.
You've received the Ig Nobel Prize too for levitating frogs about a decade ago. Can you tell us if that is as much of an honor as the Nobel Prize, or more perhaps?
I'm proud by my Ig Nobel Prize. Okay, so what's, it was great fun. Okay, we make an educational experiment, and this picture of the flying frog, probably in 50 or maybe in 100 textbooks. And when I go to conferences, at least, okay, last before this Nobel Prize, people meet me and say, oh, I know your name. You know, I use your photograph of the flying frog to start my lectures on magnetism to the freshers. And, that's how it works. And one needs to understand that Ig Nobel Prize is not given for, in most cases, it's given for fun and for some tongue-in-cheek experiments, and I fully support this prize, and there is always option to reject this prize. People who offer you Ig Nobel, they give you a couple of weeks to consider whether it would influence your career or not, and I think we're all right together with my co-recipient, Sir Michael Berry, who is a very distinguished scientist who took this prize and shared it. And it shows us that we can smile about jokes about ourselves, not only about jokes of our colleagues.
Professor Andre Geim there, clearly very tired. Nell, you've been mugging up on graphene. So essentially, it's just at the atomic level, it looks like chicken wire. And also this stuff, of course, if you roll them up, it becomes carbon nanotubes, which is another area of interesting applications.
Absolutely. I mean, you're starting with your buckyballs and then your nanotubes and various other instantiations of carbon in all its many forms are quite exciting. The thing about graphene, the reason why this particularly won the Nobel is because of the incredible properties of it, not because of its applications. It was the sort of investigation of these conductive and other fascinating properties.
Well, it's been less than a decade since the two guys actually isolated this stuff and started working on it. So it's a really quick prize.
And people are absolutely on the starting blocks for looking at what they could do with it, what they could use it for. He talked to Nature about why he hadn't filed a patent, which was that he bumped into a chap at some conference, and chatted to him about applying for a patent, which is quite, it's quite expensive to keep a patent going. And he said, if graphene is really as interesting as we think it is, then in about 10 years' time, we're going to put 100 patent lawyers onto this. We're going to write 100 patents a day, and you're going to spend all your time and money suing us trying to keep your original patent going, so don't bother.
This is the what the electronics company said this to him. So he's, there's no patent on graphene. Robin, no. get yourself down there. Yes. Get yourself a patent on this stuff.
Yes, perfect drinking straw or something.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. The nanotubes.
Well, we'll move on now to one of the next Nobels. Next, it's physiology or medicine.
The Nobel Assembly at Karolinska Institute has today decided to award the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine 2010 to Robert Edwards for the development of in vitro fertilization.
Now, what we really want at this point is someone who can give us an in-depth insight into the winner, Robert Edwards. Perhaps someone who's written a paper about the history of the research. I don't know, maybe it was published recently. Anyone got any ideas?
There's someone on the line now.
Producer Andy, who is it?
I'm Professor Martin Johnson. I'm Professor of Reproductive Sciences at the University of Cambridge, and I was one of Bob Edwards' first graduate students from 1966 to 1969.
Professor Johnson, thanks for joining us. Can you start by telling us how the Manchester-born Robert Edwards and his colleague Patrick Steptoe actually started working in the field of in vitro fertilization?
Well, each of them had come from a very different place. I mean, both of them had a strong interest in curing infertility, one from the clinical aspect and one from the scientific. And they met by chance, actually, when Bob read a paper by Patrick on laparoscopy. And this was revelatory to Bob because previously he'd been trying to recover human eggs to fertilize them, and he'd had to use tissue taken from ovaries, which had been removed as post-mortem samples. And this was proving very difficult and very time-consuming. He had trouble getting the material. He was uncertain about how useful it was to him, really. And what he saw in Patrick's technique, which was essentially the forerunner of what we now call keyhole surgery, was the capacity to get the eggs from a living ovary in a woman surgically. And so the two of them got together and brought each of their complementary skills and experiences to achieve successful in vitro fertilization within a few months, actually, of coming together. So it was a remarkable coming together of two people, both with a passion to study infertility and cure it, from very different directions.
This sounds, now IVF is a very well-used technique. 4 million babies have been born as a result. But the development that you talked about that Professor Edwards did, it wasn't plain sailing, was it, in terms of being funded by the government?
Oh, no, absolutely not. I mean, you have to put yourself back into the 1960s, and in the 60s, infertility didn't exist. Certainly in the UK, it was not considered a serious problem. People used to accuse Bob and Patrick of working on a trivial problem of very little significance to anybody, either practically, clinically, or intellectually. The great thrust in the reproductive sciences in the 60s and 70s was about population control. There was alarm about the rate at which the world population was increasing and the ability of the world to feed itself. And that drove all research on reproductive matters, the development of contraceptives, understanding the reproductive processes from the point of view of trying to develop contraceptives. So it's a very different atmosphere then.
So that meant that the Medical Research Council didn't fund Professor Edwards's work, and it was actually, how was it funded in the end?
Well, this occurred in 1971 after they published a Nature paper showing they could fertilize the human egg. And then they had subsequently done a number of studies in which they had cultured the fertilized eggs and showed they would cleave, showed they would go through to what's called a blastocyst stage with about 64 cells with a little cavity coming into the embryo. And then they applied to the MRC for funding to develop this, to transfer these embryos, hopefully to get healthy babies out. And the MRC declined to fund that. They were influenced by their dedication to population control, but it wasn't entirely for that reason. They had concerns about the ethics of what was proposed, and in the end decided not to fund it. And in fact, the work was funded partly by the Ford Foundation of America, who continued to support Bob substantially through thick and thin, and also a very wealthy private donor from California who supported his work as an individual.
Now, the other a couple of things that were going on at the time, in your the research paper you published earlier this year looking into why the research hadn't been funded, you mentioned that that Edward and Steptoe's high profile in the media was also antagonizing the referees of the research proposals.
Yes, again, that's you've got to take yourself back into the 60s and 70s when the attitudes about communicating science to the public were very different. In those days, it was frowned upon for any scientist to talk to the public in the way I'm doing now. It was the mark of disapproval amongst your professional colleagues, and also amongst the medical profession. The BMA's ethical guidance to doctors specifically forbade them talking to the press about issues, so that when Patrick did that publicly, he was castigated by his own profession because he was said to be breaching ethical guidelines. The whole idea of public information, giving the public the information, allowing them to think and discuss it, came much later, and Bob and Patrick were great trailblazers in that regard.
So they were curtailed by the scientific establishment slightly, but yet they went on, well, Professor Edwards went on to win the Nobel Prize, and so their science was good, clearly. What does this say to you as a scientist working today about how attitudes to something as supposedly objective and rarefied, as some people might think science is, what does it say about attitudes to science and how they change?
I'm not sure they've changed that much, actually. I think science is always about provisionality, about provisional truth and accepted wisdom until you can show that the accepted wisdom is wrong, and that's the basis on which science is done. And scientists are humans like anybody else. They get attached to their theories and their ideas and their grants, you know. If somebody else is getting a grant, there's less likelihood of you getting it, so there's competitive. They're human beings like all of us. And so it's the decision on whether to fund research is a highly social process, which is affected by a number of human influences and social influences, as well as just scientific objectivity.
And so culture shapes the science that we do.
Culture is a very important influence on the science we do, and it takes the maverick sometimes to break the mold. I mean, Darwin was a maverick in one sense, like that. You know, many of the greatest scientific advances have come from mavericks, but they have to break through the social elements, the social conservatism of science in dramatic ways sometimes.
Professor, thank you very much. That's all we had to ask.
Thank you.
That was Professor Martin Johnson of Cambridge University there, one of Robert Edwards' graduate students. Robin, this award, I think few people would argue that it wasn't undeserved, but it's taken the Nobel Committee 30 years from the discovery or the research that Robert Edwards and Patrick Steptoe were doing to the award. Why has it taken so long?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, it's a marked difference from the Physics Prize, which has come in a few years, and this has taken a few decades to get to us. I think part of it was this kind of fear that these children born to IVF would grow up with some kind of abnormalities, and they've waited a long time to make sure. It's an innate conservatism of the system. In many ways, I think that's unfortunate. You've got to look at the fact that, you know, if Steptoe was still alive, he would certainly share the Nobel Prize. He died quite a while ago and didn't get it. It actually raises several issues about the actual nature of a Nobel Prize, which is not given posthumously.
That's right, and that's why Rosalind Franklin famously didn't get the prize.
Yes.
Because she died by the time the award was made for the structure of DNA.
I mean, the interesting thing about that is that Nobel, in his will, didn't stipulate that it had to be posthumously. It was done by the Swedish Academy just out of convenience, as is the stipulation that a maximum of three people can get a prize and no more. These things are just done out of convenience and are bits of bureaucracy that have haunted the Nobel Prize, you know, for the last 110 years.
What Martin Johnson was saying earlier about the history of how Robert Edwards' research wasn't funded by the MRC, but it's become one of the most widely used medical treatments in the world, and is helping millions of couples. It's interesting to see the cultural impact on cutting-edge science, isn't it?
I think it speaks to some extent to the need for different sources for funding for scientific research. You know, the MRC might have particular rules, but as long as you've got a sort of a culturally accepted ethical standards that you can sort of apply fairly independently, you need different sources of funding to be able to get around sort of particularly culturally influenced decisions. I sort of think this is similar to stem cell research done during the Bush era, where federal funding wasn't available for certain types of that research, and in order to proceed we needed to go to private sources. And I think that having that kind of mix gives you a flexibility and a way to deal with different cultural and social mores that is vital in order to move on and to work out what we can do.
And in the UK even, Robin, in the past few years stem cell research wouldn't have been allowed if Parliament had had its way, and if scientists hadn't gone and actually persuaded Parliament that this was a good thing to do. So the impact that research has can only have that impact if scientists are always kind of talking and making their case.
Yes. And I mean, in fact, the Parliament, I think it's slightly harder on Parliament. I thought it had a good debate on that issue.
Eventually
had a good debate.
It wasn't going to until lots of scientists made the effort.
Yes, but it eventually got around to it. But yes, you have a point.
Okay, well, let's move on to the final science prize from last week. It's the Chemistry Prize.
The Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences has decided to award the 2010 Nobel Prize in Chemistry jointly to Professor Richard Heck at the University of Delaware in New York, USA, Professor Eiichi Negishi at Purdue University in West Lafayette, Indiana, USA, and Professor Akira Suzuki at Hokkaido University in Sapporo, Japan. And the Academy citation runs for palladium-catalyzed cross-couplings in organic synthesis.
To tell us a bit more about this, here's Nobel Committee member and professor in biophysics Astrid Grasslund.
It is about joining carbon atoms together in a way that you want to do. So if you want to say it in very simple words, you could say it's like building a Lego toy, and you want to join two pieces together, and you want to decide how and what to do with them. So this is what this reaction does. You decide, and it simply performs for your chemical reaction.
Professor Astrid Grasslund there, talking about the winners of the Chemistry Nobel Prize, or at least trying to. This prize is about carbon-carbon chemistry. This is a prize given to these three scientists for catalysis, essentially, looking at how to make long chains of carbon atoms. Now, why might you want to make long chains of carbon atoms?
In order to synthesize organic molecules.
Well, exactly.
Have you guys been rehearsing that? I
mean, that was natural. But why would you want to make long chains of carbon atoms? Because carbon is an amazing molecule. It can do all sorts of things. Of course, we know that it's the backbone of DNA and lots of other organic compounds that are in our bodies and in plants and animals and all sorts of things. But you want to synthesize these things because they can do useful things. You can make polymers, you can make artificial drugs, you can make all sorts of things. But the difficulty is that this stuff, the carbon atoms themselves, are not very reactive. You have to make them. You have to do some quite horrible chemistry to make them react. And if you do that without this technique that the three scientists developed, you get all sorts of horrible byproducts. And so their palladium chemistry,
technically known sludge,
mm-hmm. sludge, and all sorts of dangerous things. You know, all sorts of dangerous chemicals and things will turn up. So the mechanism they created, in fact, it was Professor Heck who created it first, and then the other two improved upon it, and then they produced a way of getting these carbon atoms together close enough with palladium so they would react, and then the palladium would just sort of go away, and you have this chain, and you can then put functional units on it and all sorts of things. Did anyone find my description
that
impressive?
I'm feeling sorry for the listener who haven't seen the hand show that went with it. You could even a ticket man at a sort of escort.
And at the end you get anti-cancer drugs. Hooray.
Well, let's wind up this section just by talking about the Nobel Prizes in general. Robin, these three prizes, every scientist in the world probably has some sort of half dream of winning one. So you've got physiology or medicine, you've got physics and chemistry. They came along at the beginning of the 20th century. Are they still relevant today?
I think those three are still relevant. I think the trouble is that there are other ones that are relevant as well, and that we need to think about spreading, having other Nobel Prizes. We don't have, I mean, Darwin wouldn't have got one, you know, there. How important
can
you get?
That's right. Why does biology fit into any of this stuff?
You couldn't shoehorn it into physiology or medicine. You couldn't do that. There's so much of important about climate change and the environment. I mean, this strikes me as two particular cases where we need new Nobel Prizes, because there's nothing to beat a Nobel, nothing to beat the clout, nothing to beat the controversy when it's sometimes not given for or given to their own person, allegedly.
So there are some of these other prizes, as you mentioned. The new kid on the block, I suppose, is the Kavli Prize, which is awarded by the Norwegian Academy of Sciences, I think, from an endowment by Fred Kavli. And they award astrophysics, nanoscience and neuroscience. I mean, let's say they're more 21st century subjects.
Indeed. Yes, but it just doesn't have the clout of the Nobel. It's just that, you know, Einstein got them, and you know, you've got the history that Nobel has of all these great scientists.
Some argue that perhaps you should get rid of one of the Nobels. Chemistry, for example, is that really something that is that anyone is really? And by the way, I'm sure I'm going to get hundreds of emails and phone calls arguing this is not the case. But some would argue that perhaps even the chemistry prizes don't really advance chemistry very much.
I get rid of you get rid of the economics prize because economics is bollocks anyway in the first place, so you shouldn't give it. And it wasn't even in Nobel's list. So economics prize, get rid of it and give it to something else.
We haven't even mentioned economics. But going back to chemistry.
Yes. Of course you're downer with chemistry.
No. My point is, I'm not saying I agree with this, but the point is that you could probably shoehorn most chemistry prizes into either medicine, physiology or physics. And most of the chemistry prizes awarded in the past few years have been along those lines. There hasn't been an advance in fundamental chemistry. We know quantum physics, really. And any advance in quantum physics, i.e. chemistry, is going to be physics. Really, it's not going to be a chemistry advance. Well, so perhaps you should get rid of that and award it into something else.
Yes, okay.
I think you should do a sort of working group on it. Something.
I think people should come into the comments and let us know what they think.
That's a good idea. I mean, I think that what should the prizes be awarding in the future? Physics and as you said, the Nobel Prize for Physics was won by Einstein. Every physicist wants to be associated with Einstein in some way. It would be madness in that way to get rid of something like that.
Well, then they gave Rutherford the Nobel Prize for Chemistry, and he hated chemistry. He was a physicist, and he called chemistry stinks, and they gave him the Nobel Prize for Chemistry. I mean, you know.
I turned on a positive note. I mean, it's been a great year for Britain. We spoke to Professor Geim, of course. He's a Russian-born physicist, worked in the Netherlands, now working in Manchester, and his colleague as well working in Manchester, again, Russian-born. Robert Edwards, born in Manchester. It's a great year. It's a great year for Northern science, to be honest with you. This is on the eve of possibly hugely damaging cuts to science. We've talked about this every week, and I make no apologies for it. It's a great time to be showing the government how good British science is.
It couldn't have come at a better time than that. Whether it'll make any difference to what they will do, I don't know. I hope it will.
Professor Geim might not. I mean, if the immigration cap that the government wants to implement was in place, he may not have been able to come to the UK.
Yes.
Can you imagine that?
We live in wonderful times.
All right. Well, if you want any more information on that, there's a whole page of stuff at the Guardian website, guardian.co.uk/science. And by the way, there's a new Facebook page as well, where you can get all this info about all of the stuff we do. What you need to do is go to facebook.com/guardianscience and click the like button. You can keep up to date with science stories, podcasts, Twitter, everything really there.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk.
Now, we've started hosting a series of science videos on our website in association with the Newton channel, that's at newton.tv. Here's a snippet from last week's piece. This is the man who, after several appearances on this podcast, has become Mr. Science. This is Professor Brian Cox with a handy guide to quantum mechanics and the subatomic world.
I'm standing 100 metres below the ground at CERN in Geneva. And this is the CMS detector, part of the largest and most complicated scientific experiment ever attempted. Here, we'll recreate the conditions that were present in the universe less than a billionth of a second after the Big Bang. How do we recreate those extreme conditions here on Earth? Well, you need one of these, the Large Hadron Collider. 27 kilometres in circumference and filled with over 2,000 superconducting magnets, each at 1.9 Kelvin. That means that they're colder than the space between the stars. Inside here, we accelerate protons to 99.999999% the speed of light before bringing them into collision inside four giant detectors.
There's a much longer version of that video on our website and on newton.tv. There's also a video on our website about consciousness. Professor Christoph Koch of Caltech tells us how to get a neurological handle on one of biology's biggest unknowns. For more videos, keep an eye on the website, guardian.co.uk/science. By the way, also, if you're a Twitter fan, go to Guardian Science if you want to follow all the Guardian Science news, or Science Weekly if you want to just follow this podcast. Let's move on now to something that the Guardian's In Sample has been up to for this podcast.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
Just quickly, Steve, you can give me your name and position so I can check the levels, please.
My name is Steve Jones, and I'm Professor of Genetics at University College London.
Perfect.
What I'll do is, if I say, can you just tell us a bit about the UCL lunchtime lectures, you can say what the UCL lunchtime lectures are, and then we can start there with you talking about that.
Okay.
Great, off you go.
UCL lunchtime lectures are an attempt, one of many, to reach out to the general public and show them what their taxes are paying for, that actually UCL academics do an extraordinary diversity of things, from fine art to nuclear physics. They're open to anybody, they're twice a week throughout the term, and the range and breadth and depth of them is quite astonishing.
Your own talk is kicking off this year's season, and the title's bound to attract some interest. Incest and Folk Dancing, Why Sex Survives. You explain.
Well, the quote is from Sir Thomas Beecham, who said, you should try anything once except incest and folk dancing. And it's an amusing quote. I've never undergone folk dancing, but I certainly have undergone quite a lot of incest, at least in the broader sense, in that we are all related to each other. And whenever you have sex, whoever that might be, you are actually having sex with somebody who has a common ancestor with you, and probably more recently than you think.
So how related do you have to be to someone for incest to become a problem?
For incest to become a medical problem, as far as we know, once you get beyond first cousin level, that you share with grandparents, the effect is, for individual families, fairly small. I think on a population-wide basis, with huge amounts of data, you might find a bit. Certainly brother-sister, or what's actually more common, father-daughter, incest is severely damaging, and that's not surprising. But what's remarkable is how closely related, in fact, we all are. I'll start this lecture off by showing a slide of an excavation in Israel, which is a city called Megiddo. And Megiddo is the site of Armageddon. And it was a city that was destroyed in 722 BC. And the people fled and planned to come back at the end of time in the resurrection. That was taken up by the Christian religion. And you can count how many people there should be at Armageddon. The rule, you've got two parents, four grandparents, eight great-grandparents, 16, 32, 64, and so on. And very quickly it becomes obvious, if you start doing that sum, if you go back however many hundred generations of humans to 722 BC, if everybody came back to meet at Armageddon, and they were not related to each other, you'd have a ball of humans the size of the sun expanding at the speed of light. Okay, and that's not going to happen. What that tells us, of course, that we all share ancestors because there's no room for us to have common ancestors. And in fact, we all share ancestors relatively recently. At the lecture, I think I might ask the audience whether they mind me introducing them to their sixth cousin. And I'll ask them to shake the hand of the person to their left. That's their sixth cousin. On average, you and I almost certainly share a great, 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 great grandparent in common, who probably lived in around 1859, the year of the origin of species. So that's for two Europeans, but even for people of European, let's say Afro-Caribbean ancestry, the distance isn't much greater.
The revulsion we, by and large, feel about incest presumably suggests that we can instinctively tell when someone of the opposite sex is a little too close to us genetically.
Yes, I mean, I think instinctively is a very useful word because, of course, it means nothing at all. there does seem, certainly in the animal and most of all the plant world, there are strong mechanisms to avoid close inbreeding. And in mice, for example, there are very powerful mechanisms by which a female mouse can discover through the smell of the urine how closely related a potential mate, a male mate, might be. And if she's mated, for example, with a member of her own inbred line of the laboratory mice, which are basically all identical twins, and then she's pregnant with a litter and she's offered a new unrelated male, she will immediately abort that litter in order to mate with that unrelated male. So there's a very, very strong imperative among some mammals to mate with people who are not their relatives. There have been various attempts to suggest that we can work out kinship by scent in humans. But our, we all smell awful. In other words, our scent mechanisms are much less well attuned than mouse ones are. So if the biological effect is there, it's rather small. There's certainly a cultural effect. There is a rather mythic tale that kids brought up on kibbutzim in Israel, who are not related, but are brought up as if they're brothers and sisters, tend not to marry later. That effect, I think, is less strong than is often claimed. But there's some interesting recent stuff that asks, what is the extent of sexual revulsion between two kids from the same family? The older being nauseated by the thought of sex with the younger, or the younger being nauseated by the thought of sex with the older? And the answer is that if you're the older and you've seen the younger being brought up and you're sure, because you've seen that as a baby, that it's a member of your family, then you're much more repelled by the notion of sex with that individual than if you're the younger and the older is just another person who might perhaps not be related. So there may be some biology there, but if it's there, it's probably weak and the cultural effects are much stronger.
You mentioned 1859, and Darwin was himself concerned about inbreeding as an issue, and obviously married his first cousin.
Yes.
What was the work he did on this?
I mean, whenever I say the word Darwin, I have to stand up and bow. I mean, he was an astonishing genius. We all know in 1859 that he wrote The Origin of Species, and that really gave the science of biology and grammar. It meant that biologists could do something new, that if you were interested in a biological question, inbreeding, let's say, you didn't have to just work on the plant or animal which you'd always worked on. You could ask the same question in different groups and get an answer which was relevant to all of them because they were all related to each other. And Darwin did exactly that. He had been warned by his cousin, Francis Galton, the eugenics man who actually founded my own department at University College London. We're not too proud about that. He'd been warned about the dangers of cousin marriage. Now, Darwin, being a genius, and I use that advisedly, was concerned that his wife, his cousin, and their children might, as a result, suffer. So what did he do? The first thing he did was to go and work on flowers. Now, before 1859, before the idea of common descent, that would have seemed perverse. What can you learn about human inbreeding from flowers? But Darwin saw we are indeed related distantly to flowers, and he did some classic experiments where he invented the botanical condom, which has been widely used since then, which is just a little gauze bag, where you can take hermaphrodite flowers, of which there are many. Hermaphrodites are both male and female simultaneously, and they have a constant temptation, which is what Woody Allen calls sex with somebody you really love, i.e. yourself. So they can, in principle, take pollen, male cells, and fertilize their own female egg cells with it. Some of them do and some of them don't. There's actually a rather a range. And what Darwin did was to take the normally outcrossed ones, the ones that need a pollinator, a bee, a flying penis, as we invariably say, to cross, and simply to put himself in the role of that pollinator with a paintbrush and force those plants to self-fertilize. Now, many of them refused to fertilize at all, but those that did, among those that did, most of the offspring were very unfit, in very poor condition. And that really worried Darwin. Because he thought, well, indeed, in plants, in certain plants at least, this effect is striking. Maybe it's true in humans. And he set out to find out.
And he also looked at the compositions of the boat crews from Oxbridge, I think, which he made a link with inbreeding.
He had various, there had been some concern about inbreeding before. And it's noticeable that in the Bible, in the Old Testament, there are strong sanctions against that you should not have sex in the way of the Egyptians. Now, the Egyptians, it's not actually pretty clear. Among the pharaonic line, there was extreme inbreeding. Brother-sister mating was common, often for several generations. And the Israelites didn't like this. They didn't particularly like cousin marriage, indeed, for that matter. There was a certainly quite a lot of incest in the Bible, father-daughter quite commonly. And so there were strict rules against inbreeding, some of which were rational and some of which were not. The irrational ones, which lasted until the 19th century in Britain, was that a man could not marry his deceased wife's sister. And that makes absolutely no biological sense at all, because the sister is no more related to him than his wife was. But that goes back to biblical times. So the idea that inbreeding was bad for you was already in the air. And Sir William Wilde, who was Oscar Wilde's father, who was a doctor in Dublin, was interested in deafness. He discovered, and it was a striking discovery for the time, that people who were deaf were likely, more likely than average, to be the children of cousins. So there was something out there. And Darwin took it a bit further, and with his son George, they did all kinds of surveys. They wrote to lunatic asylums. They checked the House of Lords to see whether there were more or less in either population. One very odd thing which George Darwin found is that if you go to the boat race crews of the colleges in Oxford and Cambridge, there are fewer members of those crews who are the descendants of cousins than in the general population of the nerds and reptiles who otherwise occupy those universities in those two rather unpleasant cities. So there were these anecdotal bits of evidence, but it was very difficult to find dependable evidence, because people lied and so on. Darwin actually did try to get a question about cousin marriage put into the 1851 census. And he was laughed out of court, largely, of course, because Queen Victoria was married to her cousin, and you couldn't possibly hint there might be something wrong there. Okay, so he said he and his son had yet another brilliant idea, which was a very good way of measuring common ancestry of married couples, which is what inbreeding is to look at surnames. And particularly for rare surnames, like, let's say, Darwin, or Sidebottom, or what have you, which have probably only arisen once or twice, then if a Darwin marries somebody else called Darwin, even if they don't know them, it's highly likely that they're actually descended from the same ancestor with the name Darwin. And this is a mechanism called isonymy, having the same name. And of course, it's cheap research. No doubt we'll be doing a lot more of it in the future, because all you need is a phone book. And the number of names versus the number of people in the phone book is itself a statement of inbreeding. And the number of shared names in marriages is an even more accurate one. So we have good measures of inbreeding across Europe, across the world.
We live on a very small island in Britain. Is it bad news when it comes to looking at our own levels of inbreeding?
We do live on a small island in Britain, but we're a shifty lot. We've moved around. So we're not particularly inbred, but parts of Europe are. Spain is much more inbred than we are. Asturias in the north, most of all. And very recently, in the last year or so, there's been work done with pedigrees and indeed with genes on islands in the Adriatic and the Orkney Islands, both of which turn out to be astonishingly inbred.
Your talk goes on to cover inbreeding in animals as well, and I was intrigued by this comment that I hear you're going to be mentioning about hermaphrodite slugs and why for them sex stops at Preston. I have to ask you to explain that.
Yes, well, some years ago did some work on the origin of sex, which is still one of the big questions in biology. And the big question about the origin of sex is, why do women let men get away with it? Okay, what is the point of males? Why should a female of any species allow a male to use her and hijack her DNA copying machinery to copy his genes? Why is she diluting her investment? And it still remains an active question. But one of the ways you can look at it is to look, as Darwin, of course, realized, look at hermaphrodites, Hermes and Aphrodite, things that are boy girl and girl boy. And there are plenty of animals that are hermaphrodites, and among them are slugs. Now, slugs are actually, well, all once snails. They are degenerate snails. And they're rather unusual slugs. They're, of course, extraordinarily beautiful and pleasant things to work on. They're horrible things to collect, because they look rather like dog droppings. So now and again, you make a terrible mistake. They're hermaphrodite. And if you're a hermaphrodite, boy girl meets girl boy, the slug I worked on, called Orion, the big black slug people are familiar with, you want to be the boy. Okay, what you want to do is to insert your sperm into the other partner and beat it as quickly as you can. And so they have these extraordinary mating dances and enormous penises which they club each other with in an attempt to attempt to mate. But my species is unusual, or we found it was unusual, because rather unusually, it can make the choice insofar as slugs can choose. It can go and find another partner, boy, girl meets girl, boy, which is equivalent to having normal sex, really, more or less. Or it can mate with itself. And if there are no partners around, they will turn in despair or possibly in relief to themselves and mate with themselves. Now, if you mate with yourself, then, of course, you're extremely, the next generation is pretty inbred. And if it does it again, it gets more inbred. And very soon, everybody inherits the same copy of the same set of genes. And to assess the amount of inbreeding, all you need to do is to go out, pick up your slugs, grind them up, look at their DNA or the proteins when we did it, and ask, is there lots of diversity or is there none? And there's a striking pattern, which for slugs, at least when we did the work, which was a couple of decades ago now, for slugs, as you go north through Britain, sex stops at Preston. There are some sexless patches further south. There's very little sex in Cambridge, at least for slugs. And why should this be? It actually turns out to be quite a common pattern in plants and in other hermaphrodite animals. In the north, or high up in the mountains, if you are a hermaphrodite, you're much more likely to be a self-fertilizer to go in for this botanical incest, okay? Well, it may turn on, there are arguments about it, but it may turn on differences in the nature of your enemies. North of Preston, your enemies are, I spent 10 years in Edinburgh, your enemies are cold, starvation and gloom, okay? But they're all the same. There's still cold, starvation and gloom as there was in Edinburgh as there was in the 1960s. And they don't change. So that if you've evolved a set of genes, which is very good at dealing with cold and starvation, then you can afford to keep that set of genes and selfing pays. South of Preston, in Islington and Camden, where we now are, your enemies are much more likely to be biological. They're disease, mainly disease organisms, okay? Now, these disease organisms themselves are sexual. And if their potential victims are all the same, then you're likely to get something like the potato famine in Ireland, that suddenly there's a change in the disease organisms, and every single individual, genetically identical of the host organism, goes bust. So you have to reshuffle your genes every generation, so you have to have sex. So that sex, ironically in the end, might be a defense against infection, although of course infection and sex themselves have historically tended to go together.
I had no idea incest would be so fascinating. Steve,
you should try it sometime.
Well, I've heard about it. You should, it should be the title of your next book, perhaps.
I will think about it.
Fascinating stuff. Now, before I go and cancel my weekend break in Preston, can you just do a quick plug for your lecture itself?
Tell me when that is.
Tuesday, 12th of October at lunchtime.
What time?
1:15. Are you going to be there?
I'll be there.
And you better give the web address as well.
Okay. The web address is ucl.ac.uk/LHL, and you can watch the lecture online.
Fantastic stuff. Thanks.
That's it for this week. Thanks to Robin McKee, Nell Bowes and Ian Sample. Congratulations also to our British Nobel Prize winners. It's always good to have a Nobel Prize winner on the pod once a week. Mustn't forget Steve Jones either.
I'm giving a lecture entitled, what's it called? Incest and Folk Dancing. I'm giving a lecture entitled Incest and Folk Dancing, Why Sex Survives, on Tuesday, the 12th of October, in the Darwin Lecture Theatre at University College London. And that's in Gower Street, London, WC1.
On next week's podcast,
I'm Karen James, and I'll be in the studio next week to talk about rebuilding HMS Beagle, my upcoming trip to Galapagos, and witnessing a space shuttle launch as part of a NASA tweet-up.
And Jim Al-Khalili talks about his special gig at the Royal Albert Hall with Professor Stephen Hawking.
What he'd said before was, you know, something along the lines of knowing the mind of God, which is in the same way that Einstein came up with quotes like, you know, God does not play dice. They don't mean, you know, the God of the monotheistic religions. What he's saying now is a bit stronger. He's saying that if we had a theory of everything, and he believes we're well on the way to finding one, in which case there'll be no room for God.
Don't forget to add your voice to our debate. It's always raging over on our blog at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. Subscribe while you're there too, so that every programme gets automatically delivered to your MP3 player. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth, who was nominated in this year's Nobel category for Best Science Podcast at The Guardian. I'm Alok Jha, and I have my eyes set on next year's Nobel Cake Eating Prize. Seriously, it's a new category they're doing. Thanks for listening. It is now a good time.
Yeah, that's fine.
Okay.
Can I just lock my door?
Of course.
Close my door.
Why Sex Survives. On Tuesday, the 12th of November...
You better do that again and say October rather than November.
November. God, is it October? do you want to do it from the top?
Sorry. Yeah.
I'm giving a lecture on Wednesday.
Tuesday.
My name is Steve Jones, and I'm giving a lecture on Tuesday, the 12th of November.
October.
Oh, for fuck's sake. Why do I think it's November? Maybe it's November in my diary.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.